This is Michael Leary with More Than Meets the IRB from the Human Research Protection Office at Washington University in St. Louis. More Than Meets the IRB is a series dedicated to current issues in research ethics from the perspective of research participants and the people who study them. Today, I would like to welcome Rebecca Dresser, the Daniel Noyce Kirby Professor of Law at Washington University Law and Professor of Ethics and Medicine at Washington University School of Medicine. Professor Dresser is an expert in biomedical ethics. She has been a member of the President's Council on Bioethics and currently sits on the Washington University Institutional Review Board, as well as its Embryonic Stem Cell Research Oversight Committee. Welcome, Professor Dresser.
Thank you, Michael.
We're very happy to have you. Among many other publications, you're the editor of Malignant, Medical Ethicists Discuss Cancer, which was recently published by Oxford University Press. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Biographies written by survivors of cancer have become really important. They're effective ways to disseminate information about cancer and raise awareness about the effect it has on those around us. But Malignant is a pretty unique book. This volume brings together seven medical ethicists that have been diagnosed with cancer or have had a husband or wife that have been diagnosed with cancer. The unique perspective in this book is at times harrowing, but at times very revealing. How did the idea for Malignant come about?
Well, I had a tumor in my tongue, and the treatment was only 4 months, but it was very intense. And so I had chemotherapy and radiation therapy, and I had to have a lot of pain medication. And so I didn't feel very well during a lot of it. But part of the time, I wasn't sick enough to sleep all the time. So I would lie in the bed and listen to the radio, read the newspaper. And I heard on NPR a couple of doctors come on, and they talked about how they had treated cancer patients for many years, and then they had gotten cancer themselves. And they had learned a lot about being a doctor to cancer patients by being a patient. So I thought, hey, we could do that with medical ethics. So when I felt better and got back to work, unfortunately, one of the things you discover when you have cancer is how many people have either had it or had a close loved one with cancer. So I knew some people in my field who had been through similar experiences or had, you know, had a spouse with cancer just in the last several years, most of them. So I got in touch with a group of people and asked them if they'd like to be part of a project I called Cancer and Bioethics, When the Professional Becomes Personal. And eventually, six people agreed to join the project. I wrote a grant proposal, and that got funded. So we met here at WashU twice for a few days. And the discussion was fairly orchestrated, kind of on a chronological approach, where we talked about before we were diagnosed, having symptoms or not. Some people were diagnosed just with a, you know, mammography or a prostate screening antigen, PSA test, prostate cancer. Some of us had symptoms and nobody could figure out what it was for quite a while. So various stories to diagnosis, and then hearing the bad news, making treatment decisions, and then I have a chapter I think we'll get to on deciding about being in a research trial. Then there are chapters about after treatment. You might think, oh, everyone feels wonderful after treatment, but it's actually a time where many people get depressed because during treatment you're so focused on getting through and you have a lot of support at the center and everybody is, hey, you can do it, and then treatment's over. And you just have to wait for a certain period of time to then find out, you know, was it effective? And so that period presents a lot of challenges. And then, of course, you always worry every time you go for a scan or an exam that maybe it's back. So being a survivor, what that is like. Caregiving, we have a chapter called Cancer Interactions, which is about the kinds of experiences we had, mostly outside of the healthcare setting, with our friends, our family, our coworkers, people we had to tell about what was going on. And many of the people were wonderful, but surprising number of people were incredibly awkward and, I think, inadvertently hurtful. So we wrote about that and kind of the ethics of ordinary life when someone you know has a serious disease. You know, what's mm-hmm. what are right and wrong ways to behave? And I'm going on. There are other chapters, cancer and mortality, being a caregiver, being in a support group, and the ethics of survivorship.
The ethics of survivorship is such an, I don't think I've heard that phrase in a literature before, but this book is very evocative, not just about the experience of making decisions during treatment, but the whole scope of the experience of cancer from for better or for worse in many cases. And in one particularly difficult chapter to read at times, you have written a chapter called Autonomy and Persuasion, in which you chronicle how difficult it can be to make decisions about clinical care when you're in the midst of something as difficult as cancer treatment. And at the end of that chapter, you write, "Respect for patient autonomy does not require outright acceptance of every patient choice, but not all clinicians realize this," which is an intriguing concept. And I want to ask, would you say that this is an idea that applies in the context of research, or is this a concept that really only applies in the context of clinical care?
Well, I think it could apply to both. The chapter is about my decision whether or not to have a feeding tube during my chemotherapy and radiation treatment. So I think, you know, that could come up for someone, or a similar situation could arise for a cancer patient in a research situation where basically you're in the midst of this psychologically traumatic experience. Having the treatment has its own extreme burdens often. Your whole life has been turned upside down. You're not, I mean, some people are able to continue work on a regular basis, but many aren't. So, and your relationships with everyone have changed. And so then you're asked to make some of the most important decisions you've ever made in your life. You know, they can be life and death decisions. And often there's just a huge amount of uncertainty mm-hmm. with any of the choices. And certainly that's true with research, but also with standard therapy. And I think, I know for me, I felt very, my life was out of control. So one thing I could control was, what did I say yes or no to in the medical setting? And I became very stubborn, refusing this feeding tube. So it's hard to think offhand how that could come up in a research situation, but I could imagine somebody, say, in a study who is feeling overwhelmed and say they have to go in every week for, you know, some kind of a procedure or a test or something for the study. Mm-hmm. And they're just feeling exhausted. They don't want to do it another time. They don't want to be poked and prodded or given a shot or looked at or whatever. And they just say, I'm not doing it today, or I'm quitting. And so I think that's psychology.
In either context, what seems really clear to me from the way you articulated your experience is that we tend to think that autonomy is a pretty rote concept, whereas it's actually very messy.
Yeah.
In either context.
Yeah.
And the ability for people to make decisions, whether for clinical care or in the midst of research, is something that has numerous factors that even are quite personal.
Yes.
To the individual.
As I said in the chapter, we know what our values and preferences are, and just from our ordinary life. And then if a serious illness comes up, you know, the sort of standard statement is, well, you apply your values and preferences to the decisions you're facing. But we've never had the experience of applying our values and preferences to these kinds of decisions. So I think we need a lot of help. We need, I mean, not for everything, but for some decisions. I was surprised, even though I thought I understood the information, I was making an informed decision. You know, I think I understood the risks and benefits, but I really overestimated the burdens of having a feeding tube, and I underestimated the benefits. Mm-hmm. I was, I didn't want to be in a hospital, all these things. And so I needed somebody to sit there and kind of push me and say, well, what are you so worried about having this tube? You know, you, once you have it, you can just tape it up and put it under your shirt. And nobody's going to know you have it. It's maybe bothersome, but it's no big deal. I think talking to somebody who had had one before would have been helpful. And I think that's something that researchers and clinicians might think about in situations like this. A real person who's had it, yes. Not a clinician describing it. But also, I said, I think there are values and then values in quotations, which are parts of our personality that maybe make us who we are, but they're not kind of our best selves. And so I'm a very stubborn person. So I think part of my refusal was just I was digging in. I wanted mm-hmm. to stay as independent as I could. And I really needed someone to argue with me.
And maybe that comes out a bit in the next chapter where you talk about how you were There was a trial proposed to you that you could have participated in it, but you decided not to.
Right.
Can you very briefly, in a few sentences, talk about that trial and your response to it?
Right. You can tell I'm not very brief about this stuff. Well, when I was deciding about how to have my cancer treated, I had two different options, just in terms of clinical options. And then I decided to go with radiation and chemotherapy. And then after the oncologist described the recommended regimen, then he said, oh, and there's this other option, you could be in a trial. And this was a trial where there were two groups. One of them would get three chemo drugs and radiation therapy. The other would get only radiation therapy and one chemo drug. And I was offered four chemo drugs and radiation therapy outside the trial, including one that had just been approved for head and neck cancer. So I thought intuitively, well, four must be better than any of the options in the trial. And also because I'd been on the IRB, I knew that if I said, well, I might be interested in the trial, then I'd have to have another appointment to go through the consent form and be randomized. And my cancer was diagnosed very late. It was taking a while to get going on treatment. And it was very painful. I just really wanted to start my treatment, so I said, I feel a little guilty about this, but I think I would prefer to go with the recommended treatment and not yes. be in the trial.
In fact, at the end of that chapter, you say, I'm not proud that I refused the paradigm trial. I am glad to be alive, though, and don't know whether I would be if I had enrolled in the trial. So in this chapter, we really get a sense for, many of us don't experience this, but what's so valuable about these two chapters are you get a sense for how complicated the decision-making process is at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is a concept that you address. I think Nancy King is the one who talked about how researchers should extend a fair offer to people when they're asking them to participate in research, in that asking people to participate in research should have some scientific merit and should propose some benefit relative to their condition. So given your experience, what do you think the ingredients of a fair offer are?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I wrote about was, I think many listeners will be familiar with the concept of a clinical equipoise, which is in research, certainly involving people with a serious illness, the choices in a trial, many people think, should be those that experts in the field think have an equivalent chance of being safe and effective for patients with a particular disease under study. So we don't know which of these is better. If you go to all the experts on this disease, they say, you know, we've got some evidence for one, some evidence for the other. We really need a trial to find out which is best and perhaps which is best for which people. In cancer, the trials take so long that, for example, in my case, this trial had started several years before the drug that I could get off study had been approved. So cancer is a moving target. All these new agents are being developed through the years. The trials take so long, they can't keep up with the new stuff. And so clinical equipoise is a moving target, I think, in cancer. And I think that's an issue. I think it's probably very difficult to deal with it. But I know from my point of view, that really led to my choice. You know, I felt that the options in the trial did not seem to be in my notion of equipoise compared with what I could get outside the trial. And I did feel that my doctor was kind of glad that I took the recommended therapy. And I showed him my chapter, and he didn't argue with me. So I think he was feeling the tension between being a doctor who wanted to give the treatment regimen that he thought would be best for me as an individual versus being a physician investigator who wanted to advance knowledge through the trial.
So let's say, hypothetically, a researcher is extending what we could consider a fair offer.
Mm-hmm.
Would someone then have the duty to participate in that research?
There is a whole debate going on now in research ethics about this issue of whether people have a duty to volunteer. I don't think that we do, at least at this point. I certainly think with a fair offer, more people would be willing to volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
They would be a trial would be more attractive the more fair the offer is. As far as a duty to volunteer, the people who argue about this say that the principle of beneficence says that we should not harm others, but we should also help others. And so if you take a positive view, they say we have a duty to help others through volunteering for research. Also, justice. All of us are beneficiaries of past research, so we, if we don't volunteer for research to help future patients, then we're free riders on these past contributors. I can see the weight of that argument, and I do want to say I did volunteer for a couple of trials that were that follow, you know, how I'm doing and the kind of long-lasting symptoms of radiation and treatment. And then I did go into a registry. So it wasn't that I didn't want to be in research at all. I think it was the risk-benefit ratio that made the decision for me. I think if you're going to make the case for a duty to volunteer, that really goes against the basic principle of voluntary consent that we've had in research ethics for so long. I think there are less restrictive alternatives. I think we as a society ought to do more to praise volunteerism in research. We have lots of bumper stickers for organ donors, and there's a lot of publicity valuing organ donors. We don't see that very much for research volunteers.
No, you really don't. That's an interesting point.
And when we talked about this issue in my law seminar a couple of years ago, the students were very, they had no idea there was a need. Now, of course, they would, for the most part, be healthy volunteers, but they had no idea that there was a shortage of subjects. And they said, well, you know, when the Red Cross comes to the law school and has a blood drive, we're really happy to volunteer. How come nobody ever comes here and tells us about different studies we might volunteer for? So I think with outreach and more publicity, you might meet this, do more to fill the need for research subjects without the kind of coercive element, which I think is so ethically troubling and complicated, and I don't think it would ever sell.
Yeah. And I also wish we would praise more the volunteerism that we see in institutional review board service. I know that we have long appreciated your service at our IRB and the fresh perspective that you bring.
Well, thank you.
Now, malignant really is the tip of an iceberg that's going on in research ethics conversation right now, but I also feel like it can push us toward new directions in conversation as well, even mm-hmm. at the level of the Institutional Review Board. So I really appreciate you taking this time to talk with us today.
Well, you're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
About your experience and your work. And we also thank the Washington University School of Medicine Public Affairs Office for their help in this production. Thank you for joining us.